Welcome to the Almost Reckless podcast. I'm your host, Amy Smilovic, and my guest today is Malcolm Mitchell, best-selling author, founder of Share the Magic Foundation, and Super Bowl 51 champion. Malcolm.
I can't stop smiling.
I know. We go way back.
We go way back now,
and we haven't seen each other for a few years, and this is so great catching up. First of all, do you like my ring?
I think it looks great on you.
I'm wearing this ring because, I met you when you had just left the New England Patriots.
Correct.
You had gotten injured. I know you're glad that I knew the team because I didn't forever. I'm so bad with teams.
Like, well, I don't know. For the first year, we had to work on it.
I have bad memory. But I got put in touch with you because... a guy that I had become friends with, Kelly Kerner at the University of Georgia, had put you in touch with me because you went to the University of Georgia also. We went at very different times.
Go Dogs.
Go Dogs. And you were starting a fashion line at the time. You'd been injured. You were starting a fashion line. You were trying to figure out what you were going to do.
Correct.
Why don't we start with present? Present Malcolm. Yeah. Tell me.
Are you sure you don't?
I would love it. Yes. But I feel like it looks a little bit better and more natural on your hand. Let's start with present day Malcolm. What are you doing today? What is your career, your day like?
I am a husband. Mm-hmm. I am a father. I point those two things out because even when I met you, I didn't imagine those things for myself. It's not what I saw growing up in my community.
Yep.
But career-wise, I am the founder of Share the Magic Foundation, mm-hmm. a youth literacy foundation that's focused on inspiring kids to read. Mm-hmm. I'm an author.
Yep.
And I travel around the country talking about the impact that literacy has on individuals' lives.
So that's amazing. So every day you're doing... but... I'm curious. So let's wind back now, because most people, that's not their trajectory, right? You go to college, you're a football player, you play, you have two Super Bowls in your world.
One, lost one.
And one, yeah.
I won't say who I lost it to, because before this, one of your friends taunted me.
Well, and I won't even know probably the name of the team. Yeah. Like, I'll probably name, like, the Knicks.
No. You know. Well, okay.
Different sport. But that's not a normal trajectory. And you have a really interesting story about why reading, literacy, is so important to you. And can you, I would love for you to set the stage about that for a few minutes.
Well, I grew up in Valdosta, Georgia. Valdosta, Georgia is home to the winningest high school football program in the country. Mm-hmm. Valdosta High School has won more football games and championships than any other team that has existed. And that's the community that I was raised in. Mm-hmm. So naturally, like every other child, what did I gravitate towards?
Yep.
Playing football. Now, I grew up in a disadvantaged community, under-resourced, some would call it. So I have that perspective, too. Mm-hmm. I grew up thinking football was the most important thing in the world. Mm-hmm. I went to school so I could play football. I went to class so I could play football. I behaved at home so I could play football.
Everything was in the
Everything
service of football.
Everything was kind of around being able to play the game.
Yep.
I never contemplated there being any other way to live a meaningful life. Mm-hmm. Why? Mm-hmm. Well, if you go back to my community, there's no one walking around the neighborhood with a book taunting their intellectual prowess.
Right.
There are more liquor stores in proximity to the house I grew up in. There are bookstores. Mm-hmm. There are not doctors. There are no lawyers. There are no firefighters. There are no policemen. None of those people live in that community. So this idea that you could be anything else was kind of far-fetched. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like believing in something that you don't see.
Yep. Yep.
So I went my whole life just thinking football was it.
Yep.
Thankfully, I had the skill set to get recruited, mm-hmm. and I decided to go to the University of Georgia. Mm-hmm. And in that environment, I began to notice things that I had not seen before.
So how challenging was that? I mean, you're now in college, though. Like, it's, right. You know, what was it like showing up in classrooms? Did you feel disadvantaged in the classrooms as well? Like, was there a tension that you felt more behind than other students, or?
I felt that instantaneously.
Uh-huh.
They were doing things that I had never seen before.
Yep.
Like study.
Yeah.
You know, they're carrying backpacks.
Yeah.
They were sitting on the front lawn enjoying their cappuccino and doing their absolute best to perform well in the classroom. Mm-hmm. I just hadn't seen it from that perspective. I remember there was one student who got like an 89 on their exam and they went crazy.
They were upset.
They were upset. And I was getting, you know, 70 thinking... Yeah. You know,
I passed.
C, A, yeah. Sounds yeah. like we're headed in the same direction.
Right.
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 Well, for the first time, I did feel inferior
mm-hmm.
in the classroom. And I wanted to do something about it. I think
because you're competitive.
I think my competitive nature kicked in first because I knew that those students could outperform me intellectually.
Mm-hmm.
And that bothered me mm-hmm. just as a competitor.
Mm-hmm.
How I stumbled upon reading is a much different story, but it started with this person can do this better than me.
Mm-hmm.
I feel inferior. I don't like that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I can either lay down
mm-hmm.
or I can stand up.
You know, it's so interesting that you say the way that you're describing this, because one of the things that we've been talking to people about just in terms of personal style and then even career growth is really drilling down to your core skill set and seeing what opportunities there are that really match that skill set. And it's really interesting when you're saying that for a football player, you have to be competitive as hell. And so that competitive drive coupled now with real exposure for the first time, like that was probably, I mean, in some respects it may have been, I really just would have been the tipping point to kind of get you
well
on your way.
Okay. Here's the thing about people who grow up in the type of community that I grew up in. The thing that they want most, more than anything else, is not to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Right. People don't yeah. naturally want negative outcomes for their life.
Yep.
I talk to hundreds and thousands of students annually, and I often ask the question, who wants to go to jail?
Mm-hmm.
And nobody puts their hand in the air.
Right.
I say, who wants to drop out of high school? And no one puts their hand in the air.
Yeah.
Who wants to be on government assistance programs? Nobody puts their hand in the air. So that tells me that in a perfect world, mm-hmm. nobody wants those outcomes.
Yep.
Right. But the question then becomes, well, what do you do about it?
Yeah, because it's very often easy in life, in business, in communication to know what you don't want.
Correct.
But knowing what you do want and then the steps to get there, totally different. It's just very different. It's a very different level of understanding. It's something that usually you need guidance and help with to get there. So when you ask people what they don't want, probably what they do want is not so easy to come off the tongue. I mean, it might just say like, I want money, I want out, but that's not
right.
Really...
That's not how it works.
Yeah.
That's not how you accomplish a goal. That's mm-hmm. not how you get from point A to, you know, point S
mm-hmm.
or Z
mm-hmm.
or however far you're trying to get.
Yeah.
But one thing's clear to me at this stage of life, because people would often ask me, well, what made you do it? Because it was not like I was having trouble on the football field.
Right.
Now, I was a freshman when I picked up on my challenges with reading, but I was like all SEC freshman of the year.
Yeah.
My professor was asking me to sign autographs for their children. I was taking photos yeah. with professors to show their family members while yep. I'm struggling in their class.
Yep.
And it was all confusing.
Yep.
Here's why. Because the kid who was getting an A never got any attention.
Yeah. Yeah.
The student who was the valedictorian at my high school, they weren't on the front page of the newspaper. I was.
Yeah.
So the world was kind of sending me these messages to confirm you know, the false reality that I was pursuing.
Yeah, and that you were valuing that attention as well. Like, we've talked a lot, I'm just you and I personally, in terms of understanding what it is in life that you value. And if you were valuing attention in that way, there are so many things in life that you do that you will find very meaningful, but they will not get you the front page of a newspaper. They won't even get you a thank you or a pat on the back from someone else. So it's really valuing stuff for yourself and validating things for yourself, regardless of what anyone around you.
That's a difficult journey.
Yeah.
You either are born with that naturally,
mm-hmm.
or you have to acquire it through the process of going after what you think you should be and learning.
Yeah.
It's actually not what it seemed to be. And that was my experience.
But how, I mean, I'm just amazed at how, like, you couldn't have had a big network around you to help you figure this stuff out. I mean, one thing that always stuck with me, I remember in 2019, you came and stayed with us out at our house. And
you know, I haven't been invited back. I wonder if
you'll be invited back. And we did Christmas together on St. Simon's.
That's true.
All right. But I remember when we were having dinner in Connecticut, and it was a very, in my book, like one of the shitty dinners, right? Like, I made the pasta, I put in the red sauce, and then we were like done with it.
And we watched Walk the Line.
That
was my first time.
So good.
Listening to Johnny Cash ever since. You introduced me to him.
I did.
Yes.
Yay. But I remember you said, this is the first time I sat down with a family for dinner. You know, like, because we were just sitting around talking. And I'm just thinking, when I'm here and I'm talking about how, like, oh, I don't need value from a page on a newspaper or something, but I always needed value from my family, you know, like, and that, like, you really were operating, I mean, incredible mom, right? Like, she's fully, like, your right hand at your event. But, like, you had that full network wasn't there. So you were, where were you grabbing? I mean, I guess you were grabbing it from football, right? In the beginning.
So what my mother gave me that I really enjoy about myself is being open-minded.
Mm-hmm.
Everything and everyone has value. It is my job to alter my perception at times to extract and see that value.
Yeah.
I've pretty much had that since I can remember.
Yeah.
My older brother gave me a relentless spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I may lose, but whoever beat me just either outworked me,
mm-hmm.
or they had something that I didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
But to beat me is going to take a lot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. It's the combination of those two things that made me a decent athlete.
Yeah.
But I think it's the combination of those things that have helped me grow, pay attention, and embrace things that may be drastically different than what I've seen previously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's through that open-mindedness that I think I've been able to navigate and pay attention.
Yeah, because as you're navigating this, I mean, for a lot of people, okay, maybe you're getting the value from a family member, from newspapers, et cetera. But a lot of people also probably, you know, a lot of young people will write to me and they'll say, I want you to mentor me. You know, please mentor me. Or, you know, I want to fixate on one person and really understand what is it that they did to do exactly what they've achieved in their career. And then if I do that, therefore, I will hopefully be like them and be successful in the same way. You didn't, right? But like, you were, who is a ex-footballer, dabbled around in fashion, incredible speaker, charismatic, writes books. Like, there's no one like you out there. So you were kind of putting together the recipe without knowing what the outcome was going to, with the fully baked Malcolm, which, I mean, I can't even, you're not fully baked, right? Like,
I don't think
it's still baking.
Right.
But you had to be confident in the ingredients that you have for yourself, that they all just kind of come together and they're going to create something amazing.
Well, yes, but after I finished playing football, the confidence was shot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I came up here and I spent a lot of time with you learning, growing. And at the end of the day, you know, I left.
Yeah.
And I stayed away for a while because through this exploration and fashion and spending time with you and your family, there's one word that came to mind, and that was authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I saw on you. That's what I saw in Tibby. It's why I love the brand. It's just true to its core. And I didn't have that in 2019 when I finished playing football.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took several counselors. Some quit on me because I can be difficult at times.
Really?
You know? It took a lot of soul searching that took me places I would have never imagined. And through that difficult process, I came out on the other side with true understanding of who I am and what I'm not.
So when you were, because when I met you, you showed up at my office with a hanging bag with some designs in it.
Correct.
So when you decided not to pursue fashion, did you feel like that was, I mean, you weren't a failure at football. You got injured. You your Achilles tendon, right?
Listen, that was a great guess because that's a serious injury. But okay. It's knees.
It was something bad.
Yes.
And that a tendon, it's not in your knees.
It is a tendon.
But it's, Oh, Achilles. Heel.
Yes. There you go.
Right. Achilles heel.
See, this is.
Okay. I can tell you a seam allowance. Yeah. Anyways. But did you feel like, well, shit, this is like this path isn't working out.
With fashion?
Either, yeah. Like, did that demotivate you at all? Or was it just something you were trying and you were able to swipe?
All right. There's this parable. You know I'm from Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
So we have several spiritual parables.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you one. There's two men. Let's call them, you know, man A and man B. Mm-hmm. Man A wanted to go out to sea, right? So he jumps in the boat. And he paddles and he gets into the middle of the ocean and a storm comes. He gets twist, turned, knocked out of his boat. He gets back in. But when the storm settles, he has no idea where he's at. He has nowhere to go. He's lost. Well, man B gets in his boat. But before he goes out to sea, he checks to make sure he has an anchor. He has food. He has water. He's prepared. So he goes out to sea. Same storm hits him. He gets twist, he gets turned, he gets thrown around. The storm settles, and he's been anchored the whole time. So once the storm settles, he just continues down the path he was headed.
Mm-hmm.
I was a man with no anchor. And I had to leave for a while to go locate an anchor.
How'd you do
that? Or rediscover one that existed. Oh, man, it was difficult. It first came with humility.
Mm-hmm.
I had to accept that the one thing that gave me value in a public setting I no longer possessed.
Mm-hmm.
I had to find value in myself outside of that.
Yeah.
I drove home every Sunday for maybe 3 or 4 months to go to church with my mother in Valdosta.
Yeah.
That's where I started.
Wow. Uh-huh.
I tried to cut out, you know, old vices that I had developed in, you know, that fast-paced lifestyle.
Yep. Were you with Yasmin at this, your wife?
Jasmine and I started dating again.
Yeah.
But I was still kind of doing the same thing. She wasn't, you know, and I committed to that relationship.
Yeah.
And then I had to find authenticity. And who I was, which is drastically different than what I saw growing up is drastically different than what I experienced in NFL locker room. It's drastically different than the message that was being sent to me, right? I'm from the South, and what does that mean? Well, we have strong beliefs, period. And I was into fashion. And at its core, I was just into exploring ways to express yourself. Well, I come from an environment and a community and a culture where self-expression has
consequences.
It has consequences. It has guidelines. You can't overstep. And I was stepping on every line possible. Because that's what I felt. And that's who I am. But at the time, I didn't know how to embrace that. And I felt like football gave me permission to do that. No one would judge you.
You know, you're like, you're, oh, he's eccentric because he's a baller and he can do whatever he wants.
So you're kind of protected from the glorification of being this athlete. Well, you take that away and I just become that person who expresses myself differently. Well, the message that is sent to you changes also. And I had to find out how to be okay with that. I mean, you can ask Jasmine. I took out my earrings. I stopped wearing clothes the way I like them.
I know it's just there. I mean, it's fascinating hearing it from this point of view because I experience this talking to people all the time who feel like they don't have a right to wear certain things or they feel like other people are judging them. And by the way, when other people are judging them, whether or not, should you ever care? Like maybe they just are going to judge and maybe it just doesn't matter at all. And I really think that I would imagine that when you put your earrings back in and everything, that's when you started to feel like you were getting yourself back, you know, and and doing things because you wanted to do them rather than because it was the trope of how a baller was allowed to dress or, you know, I know baller is not the right word. I mean,
it's
that's
okay.
Like,
we can. Yeah, we've evolved from that phrase.
But,
we don't want to use that one either.
We don't, because you're a really nice dad with two kids and you love Jasmine. So you're not a player. But so now you're finding yourself. You're getting back. When did you write that first book?
I wrote my first book, The Magician's Hat, in college. And at the time it was...
The magician's hat right here.
At the time, it was a fun project, and I've always felt the need to share what I've learned with communities. Because I always thought to myself, I can't be the only one who missed this.
Feeling this way.
The Magician's Hat is a story about kids understanding the power of books and how they can help you make your dreams come true. I didn't understand that philosophy when I was a kid in class. They were telling me to read Charlotte's Web, and I was thinking, I don't care what happens to this spider. You know, my friends are actually dying. You know? And it just, because of Winn-Dixie, we didn't have pets. We could, you know, we were trying to feed ourselves. Like these concepts, I just didn't get it. But once I understood, I realized it's actually not about the plot of the book. It's the exercise that helps you alter the way you perceive the world around you. And it's through that you gain access to more. Well, the Magician's Hat was my attempt at telling every kid in the world to open up a book and read. Trust me. It's going to help you more than anything else. But I had no idea to turn into what it has today.
So you wrote the book. You're going on now. You're playing for New England.
Great job. High five.
That was so weak. But honestly, it was
There we go.
You're injured. You're back. You're trying to figure out what your anchor is. How did you start writing again? Like what, You know, all
no,
these
things. I stopped writing. Because you gotta realize.
You gotta feel something to start writing.
It's not even that. Go to a bookstore, flip over the book, look at a picture of all the authors in the children's book section and tell me how many of them look like me and have a similar story. Mm-hmm. I didn't read my first book on my own until I was 19.
Right.
And here I am trying to be an author of any sort. And man, it was on me. So I was like, this is a bad idea. Mm-hmm. It's not going to work. It doesn't make any logical sense. I struggled to read majority of my life. Mm-hmm. And here I am now trying to be an author and encourage kids to read. I had the book. I actually had a deal with Scholastic. But while all this is taking place, I'm thinking, it doesn't make sense.
So you're actually thinking, these guys at Scholastic, what do they know? Like, why? I mean,
I pulled one over. I was like,
right. You're thinking like,
I mean, I thought, man,
smoke and mirror.
They
it's like,
signed
in the,
me
they
up
could
for
figure
three
me out.
Books. I had this one, you know, the second one hadn't come out yet. The third one won't come out until next year.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, how long before
they figure you out?
Yes. Now, I've always enjoyed writing. I've always appreciated the activity and the experience of crafting words like a person would craft a painting or how you would design, mm-hmm. you know, clothes. You think about the fabric, you think about the color, you think about how it's going to wear. Well, you can do the same thing with words and their impressions on people's brain. So I've always enjoyed the ideal of it. But again, go back to Valdosta, Georgia, and ask anybody if they thought I'd be trying to write picture books to inspire kids.
Yeah.
They'd probably look at you and say,
Malcolm who?
What's a picture book author? That's not how we conceptualize information there.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? It's far-fetched.
But, you know, it's interesting. I think about this a lot, is how do we speed up time so that everything doesn't have to be hindsight? Because to me, as a business person, when you're, and maybe with Scholastic as well, I would have thought that when you're saying, how many books do you pick up where the author looks like me on the jacket? I'm thinking, exactly, there's your opportunity. This is new. This is marketable. This is different. I want that, you know, like, that is special. And I think how, you know, and this is aside, you know, but even like with Tibby, forever, I have always felt the imposter. And even when I went and joined American Express, I had something happened early on that let me, that gave me permission to just be myself. I'm a Southerner, University of Georgia. All of a sudden I'm at American Express and everyone is Harvard and Brown and Duke. And like, oh my God, the woman that went to Duke, they were like, oh, she went to Duke, you know? I'm like, go Dogs. But in my plain spokenness, in my knowledge, in my silliness of thinking that a summer vacation was something that you only did in the summer because both your parents worked jobs in a school system and they would have the summers off, and that's when you could save up that little bit of money to get in your station wagon and go camping on your way to visit your grandma, that's what a vacation looked like. They saw it as, oh, maybe Amy is going to help us speak to green card members. Maybe Amy is going to help us broaden our demographics. And, you know, so all of a sudden I was able to tap into what should have been a weakness. I was able to tap into that as a strength. Right. You know, oh, Amy, what does someone shop at who needs to go to IKEA? And I'm like, you can afford to shop at IKEA. And they're like, yes, we need to be talking to you. You know, you can use these things as strengths. Because right now, as you're saying the jacket book cover thing and what you have now accumulated as your skill set that you're putting into what you do every day.
The moment,
those are so unique, and those are your strengths.
The moment I learned that lesson, what you just articulated, is when things began to shift.
Yeah.
You know, because I remember getting to the University of Georgia, and the first thing I tried to do was change my Southern accent.
Uh-huh.
Because country wasn't this very
good
positive
job, by
statement.
The way. I was just thinking earlier when, right? Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yes.
It's not seen as a plus.
Right.
At least it,
we're going to talk Southern by the end of this.
You
okay?
know, give me a glass of wine. It'll come out strong.
I know. People don't realize yeah, that. Every yeah, now and then when I drink, they're like,
No, it's
are you
there.
Drunk or are you Southern? I'm like, maybe both.
But exactly.
Okay. All right. Sorry. Go on. So, yeah. So you're hiding your accent a bit.
Right. I always had, you know, I don't even watch football.
Mm-hmm.
Throws people off. Right. I watch cartoons.
Yeah.
And I've always been fascinated with art and texture and a bunch of things that football players don't get credit for immediately. Now, that's changing.
Mm-hmm.
And it has changed. Mm-hmm. I think you see a lot of the guys on runway shows mm-hmm. and doing all sorts of stuff now. So
yep.
that's not true anymore.
Yep.
But this is before people used to talk about hyper-masculinity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I was in the middle of hyper-masculinity without it having a phrase.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So all these feelings and emotions, you really don't know what to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, this is after I'm playing, after I go to church with my mom, I realize that the thing that I'm running from is actually my value.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The thing that I'm trying to get away from, I didn't want to be a nonprofit leader.
Yeah.
I mean, what kid grows up in...
I'd like to be... Yeah, no, it doesn't roll off the tongue.
The ideal of it wasn't cool.
Yeah.
Right? And I wanted to be cool. And
yeah.
My ideal of cool wasn't that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that you could sustain a certain lifestyle from writing picture books.
Yeah.
I didn't know any picture book authors. I had no idea how any of it worked.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound that cool.
Yeah.
You know, so I ran away from that too.
And even, because I would even imagine, like you said, you watch cartoons or whatever
right.
too, but it's funny when you grow up in a small town, and I think, Valdosta is a small town, but your environment in Valdosta was much smaller than
correct
the city limits of Valdosta.
It's relatively small. We have about
yeah. We had like carpets.
Yeah.
They make carpets
we
there.
We have Walmarts and
right.
Yeah.
And oh no, they don't make carpets in Valdosta. That's Dalton. Anyways, Valdosta is very small. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking even St. Simon's. It was. St. Simon's, the zip code on the island was a wealthier zip code, but to be a banker meant that you were the teller.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
You were like maybe the regional, the person who ran that bank, but you were not Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan, you know, and you had teachers and you had lawyers and then maybe you had like the Pepsi distributor, right? Like those were the jobs. And so even though I was wearing clothing, I never thought about a clothing designer.
Right.
You watch cartoons and you're not thinking, well, someone's drawing this, someone's writing this, someone's programming it. Somehow you're just watching it and it's not hitting home.
Never crossed my mind.
Yeah. That these are things that, is that a lack in a school system? Like, where is it that?
This is why I champion reading to the degree in which I do.
Yeah.
Once I got to the University of Georgia, I concluded that reading was what I believe to be the most self-empowering tool a person could possess,
mm-hmm.
period. We have historians who say reading set them free,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
We have people who say through reading they gained strength and access to information that allowed them to change their life. People say things like this.
Yep.
People have said things like this, but we haven't really embraced it.
Yeah, it doesn't hit until
right?
you, yeah.
Oh, I mean, only roughly around 40% of kids in America are reading on grade level by third grade, right? There are some states that predict dropout rates based on third grade reading scores. one's reading ability is attached to life expectancy, obviously financial opportunity, social mobility. Every aspect of our life is impacted by our ability to read. Yet,
it's not the number one emphasis.
No, it's not. In a few states, that's changing, but it's still not placed on the pedestal it needs to be on to have substantial change in our country.
Yeah.
And there are many reasons for that. Some of it is systems that were put in place. Some are change is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Some is not understanding the power of this tool. I watch stuff like old presidential debates, right?
Yeah.
And I think the first televised debate was 1960. And in that debate, JFK says, there's no greater investment that we can make
mm-hmm.
beyond investing in education.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was 1960.
Yeah.
We're still saying the same thing now because we hadn't really committed to the degree in which we vocalize at times.
You know, what's interesting in that debate, I mean, just interesting to think about, is you're talking about the content of what JFK said, but what is also famous about that debate was that Nixon was sweating and he looked very uncomfortable and old on the TV, and JFK looked very young and poised. So also at the same time, that was when you really had that moment where a picture or a video was worth a million words.
Fair enough.
And I think probably zoom forward now, people are too literal about that. And those pictures aren't worth a million words anymore. They're coming on our screens at such a fast pace. You're not absorbing, you're not reading, you're not internalizing stuff. And I can't even imagine, you know, because when you and I left off in 2020 in terms of like seeing each other frequently and you going on this journey, the whole world of social media was just escalating exponentially each year, right? And that's so, it's so damaging with reading and it's so damaging, I would imagine, with what was, were you staying away from that to keep your head clear when you were trying to find your anchor?
I've deleted my personal social media accounts maybe 5 times.
Yeah.
It stopped making sense to me.
Yep.
And the icing on the cake is one Mother's Day. I was with my mother the whole day.
Mm-hmm.
I did whatever she wanted to do.
Yeah.
I did my absolute best to make sure my mother felt appreciated on this day.
Mm-hmm.
That evening, I check my social accounts, and everyone has posted their mother. And I did not. And I felt like, man, I didn't celebrate my mother. I didn't do a good job for my mother on Mother's Day. And then simultaneously, as this happening, I'm thinking, well, wait a second.
You did the real work.
She's not even on social media.
Right.
So she won't know.
So who is this performance for?
Why do I feel this way? And I conclude that I feel this way because I think it's herd mentality. Everyone else was doing it. I did not do it. Therefore, something must be wrong with me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I deleted it for the first time because that didn't make sense.
But so when you're going through that thought process at the time, I mean, there's so many analogies then to you trying to figure out what was going to be your path for you, you know, like separating herd mentality, separating it from seeing what everyone else is doing and what you should be doing. Because what you ended up kind of cobbling together, right? You're a personal speaker now. You have the fund,
Foundation.
Foundation. And then you are a writer, right? So you're there, these three things.
Yes.
But when you started, did you see them on a line as separate or were they?
They were definitely separate.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want to do any of them.
Mm-hmm.
I was never.
Were these things that you were doing until you found what you thought you would really want to do? Were these just like, okay, I can do this, so I'll just do it for right now?
I've always believed in supporting and helping if people feel like I can.
Mm-hmm.
All right. If you call me and say, Malcolm, I need your help or I need your support, and I can do something to support, I will.
Mm-hmm.
So educators were still reaching out saying, Malcolm, we would love for you to visit our school and talk with our students.
Yep.
And I always put that before my selfish feelings. Mm-hmm. So I would go.
Yep.
So I was still doing these things while I'm having this feeling. Mm-hmm. Very much so imposter syndrome.
Yep.
I don't know why they're calling me, but they feel like I can help, so I'll show up.
Yeah.
I did that for about 2 years, and then I came across this blues term, because I love blues music. It's called Finding the River.
Mm-hmm.
And what they mean is find the flow, and once you find the flow of the music,
mm-hmm.
you exist within the flow and you can get a bit more creative.
Yeah.
Well, when I heard that phrase, I thought about my life
mm-hmm.
and me finding the river. And once I sat with my own thoughts for a while, I realized I was swimming against the current.
Did you sit with your thoughts or did you write them? I'm just curious.
Both.
Mm-hmm.
Both.
Mm-hmm.
I sat with them. I wrote them down. I argued with myself.
Yep.
My mother probably told me this as an analogy or something, but I took it serious. She was like, look in the mirror and find out who you want to be. Mm-hmm. Ask yourself who you want. Well, I would literally do that.
Yep.
I would set a timer for an hour and I'd have to talk to myself for an hour.
And did you say stuff that you knew you were lying to yourself?
All the time.
So, yeah.
All the time. But I also knew when I was telling the truth.
Yep.
And what happened, what happens when I read?
Sorry, quick question on that point. You knew when you were telling the truth. Was there a difference in your body when you told the truth? Like, did your shoulders relax?
I got relaxed.
Because that's what I see. But it's this moment where you just kind of ease into yourself that you feel it, literally.
I relaxed. It's funny, when I started doing that, I could only look at myself for maybe about 30 seconds and I look off. But the more...
Especially when you're lying. Right. You can't...
The more I got honest with myself, you know, eventually I was staring into my own eyes, mm-hmm. literally for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it helped.
Yeah.
It helped me a lot.
Mm-hmm. This is new to me, this idea. And that's really interesting. Like, it's very interesting. I try writing it and I feel impostery, like ridiculous writing things that I feel like I should want, but that I know that I don't really want. But to actually say it and have to look at yourself while doing it, that's like an ultimate test.
That was difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was very difficult. And it came from, my mom just has these gems she'll throw out. I remember when she said, you can be the best football player you can be, or you can be the best person you can be. Being the best person will last a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that stuck with me, right?
Yeah.
Wake up every day and put your best foot forward.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so these little sayings that you are who you hang around.
Yeah.
These little sayings that I kind of brushed off when I was growing up, I now try to practice every day.
Yeah. So you said that the three things, the foundation, the speaking, and the writing, were separate.
Correct.
When did they start to merge together for you?
They started to merge together once I stopped swimming against the current.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I start writing books first.
Yeah.
And it's all I really thought about.
Yeah.
Then the foundation came along because so many educators were asking me to send a message to their students. I didn't want them to have to pay for it.
Yeah.
So I had to figure out how to support all these different communities without the funds coming from the families or the educators. So naturally a foundation came about.
Yeah. And then you found that the more talks that you gave, the better the writer, speaking. The better the...
Man.
Speaking is everything.
I had no idea. In fact, my mom used to just say some wild things like...
Mm-hmm. We need to have your mom on.
Yeah, she used to say stuff like... you can be whatever you want to be. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember I told her I wanted to go to the NFL, and she was like, great, you can do it.
Do it. Yeah.
I told her I wanted to write books. She said, that's amazing. You can do it. Yeah. You know, and she always allowed me to believe. Mm-hmm. And she used to say, one day, you're going to say something and thousands of people are going to listen. This is in the middle of me being a football player at the University of Georgia. So I'm like, Mom, what are you talking about?
Right. This because she's saying, sane and listen. She didn't say you're going to throw a ball and have thousands of people watch.
First off, I don't like talking in front of a lot of people.
Yeah.
That was my mentality then.
Yeah.
And she was saying stuff like that. I had no idea the power of a person's voice.
Yeah.
I had no idea. But today, those three things work together. I'd be dishonest if I said I strategically did that.
Yeah.
It was more so of, you know, when you're fighting against something you should be doing.
Yeah.
Because you're just drawn to it, or it kind of stalks you. It won't go away. No matter how much I wanted to be left alone, these educators don't even know they were helping me. Right.
Well, I think that's where, I find that in order to do ultimately big things, in order to do anything really, you have to take some risks. But risks are scary. And one of the ways to get moving towards that is just to take the pragmatic next step, because the non-pragmatic choice, you overthink it. There's too many reasons why you can delay it, but you need to just get moving forward. And that's where I think when you really drill down to what you're getting out of an experience, instead of focusing on the description of it, but what you're really getting out of it is when you start to build this unbelievable skill set. So a lot of younger people tell me, they say, well, right now I'm going to take a job selling shoes because I'm really just going to have to do this until I get into my career doing whatever it is, finance, whether it's marketing, whatever. But I will do this just to make the money until I can really get focused here. And they dismiss entirely this sales job that they've taken on. And I'm thinking sales is, or waitressing, it is the ultimate way to learn how to convince someone to do something, to have to tell a compelling story, to have to close a deal, to start something and finish it. So you're not
selling
a shoe or bringing just a plate to the table. You're learning time management. You're learning how things work. And you being forced to speak to people, being forced to organize your thoughts, being forced to compel someone to do something, and then coupling that with this side of you that is truly good and altruistic. So you know that you're wanting to compel someone to do something good, right? Like you're not right. Asking them to, you know, these are good things. This is getting kids to read, you know.
I sit with this range of perspective, right? And that's why sometimes I hesitate when I speak, because I have this perspective of the kid who grew up in a single parent household.
Yep.
Right. With not a lot of financial assets. And then I have this experience as a Super Bowl champion.
Yep.
And all that comes with that. And then I have this other perspective as, you know, someone who does everything that we just talked about.
Yep.
And I carry all three of those into almost every conversation I have. Mm-hmm. And I can understand why a person would say, you know, I'm going to do this until I can chase after what I really want.
Mm-hmm.
But it's based on them not understanding the value of this
of what they're doing.
Right? Because it's frowned upon.
Right.
It's not, no one celebrates the role of a waitress to the degree in which you just shared.
Yeah.
You're absolutely correct. There's value in all that we do. There's an opportunity to practice a skill set that should take you exactly where you want to go, but we spend so much time judging each other off of phases of life that sometimes you get stuck there.
Well, or you're not recognizing those things that have happened to you. You're not recognizing them as the key source of your strength. You are using them as the key source of what's held you behind. And once you can realize that these things are your ingredients, not better than others, just different than others.
I'll tell you when I stop caring what people think. I'll tell you when I stopped. 2019, when I met you, I had everything the world said I should have based on society's messages, right? I made it to the NFL, so I had some money.
Yeah.
I made it to the NFL, so I was popular. I didn't have any responsibilities. I could do whatever I want. There are really no restrictions on my life. It's the saddest I had ever been. And that's when I stopped caring about what people thought, because I realized the messages that I'm receiving, they are incorrect, because I did exactly what you said I should do.
Yeah.
And I feel like nothing. So obviously these things don't quantify or lead to the outcome that we ultimately desire.
Yeah.
And that's when I stopped chasing, and I could appreciate the moment, and I could look at a situation and say, it doesn't matter if I'm speaking to one person or whether I'm speaking to a million, that is an opportunity to get better at something I'm enjoying doing.
Yep.
But you either learn that the hard way or you listen, right? And you avoid learning it the hard way.
Yeah, and I think about that, like, you got there and you knew how empty it was, and that you had to determine your own, how you were going to measure success needed to be determined differently than how other people were measuring it or measuring it for you. And I think it is hard when you are hearing messages that you can't figure that out until you've landed there yourself, you know? Right. And that's how I think, you know, when you and I met in 2019, that's when we were kind of at the top of our game as well at Tibi, but the top of our game as would be deemed by the press, you know, in 1,000 stores and agents, you know, PR agencies all over the world and blah, 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 you know, on track to be 150 million, then you're on track to be 300 million and you can sell yourself and go live on a yacht. And it was the emptiest I'd ever felt.
Why do you think that is?
I think that I didn't have control over my life to do the things that would make me happy, but I didn't know what happy meant for me. You know, like, was happy tied to money? Was happy tied to an article in Vogue? You know, if Anna had just given me an article in Vogue, would that have made me happy? You know, you kind of, you reach for the typical things, right? And really what I found was that the contentment of being around people who share a similar mindset and have active conversation and discourse, and, you know, that is where I find my contentment. I can't believe how happy I am to have a very highly debated conversation with someone where we disagree about something, but we have total agreement in how you go about disagreeing.
Right. That is a great feeling.
It is so, yeah. Like, I thrive on that.
It's liberating, actually.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so once you figure out that you thrive on doing your own thing and being around people who share a similar mindset, you can start to classify all the different things that you're doing in your life that are at odds of that, right? And so for you, you know, I'm sure you found that with the three things you were doing, each one of them was giving energy to the other. And
that's what blew me away.
Mm-hmm. Because you didn't know it was a strategic plan. If you had sat down even in 2021 and started to write,
I probably screwed it up.
You would have, right?
Right. Yeah, it's. There's a guy by the name of Jeff Markley who lives in Boston, Massachusetts. He owns a data storage and telecommunications center. It could have expanded beyond that at this point. It's called the Markley Group. And one day I was having a conversation with him. He went to the University of Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And I was having a conversation with him because it seems to me that he's in this tech space.
Yeah.
So I started talking to him about or asking questions about technology and generators. And he says, well, I know I can have the conversation, but that's not my deepest interest. I said, oh, well, what is it?
Yeah.
He says, real estate and architectural design. I said, well, what? How does that work? He says, oh, I see the challenge you're having. You're thinking about it in its, you know, most common state. Well, I'm in real estate for technology.
Mm-hmm.
And poof, at that moment, I realized, and it's probably not popular to say it, but I'll say it anyway. There's more than one way to skin a cat.
Yeah. Correct. And that's,
you know,
exactly it. And I think that when people get very binary about, I want to be creative, therefore I will go and get an art degree and work in a, it's like,
sure.
I felt so creative when I was at American Express crunching the numbers and selling stuff because you're taking a creative approach to it. You know, really,
that
waitressing
is,
can be,
man,
creative. You know,
it all can be. I mean,
and it's not just you waitress and then go home and paint at night. Like, you can actually put these things.
See, I can feel my brain fighting against wanting to accept that, you know, holistically,
mm-hmm,
because of the challenge that I know exists for some people.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, I think about my mother,
mm-hmm,
three children. We were living with our grandmother. She had to find a place for us to live. How is she able to exercise
that,
what we're talking about? Because what we're talking about is for those who either have already acquired what's necessary to think that free and behave that free.
Yeah.
Or those who have gone through the process like I have and said, oh, wait a minute, that's, you know, do you actually know what you have to give up to get $300 million? You know, so, well, you say it's not worth it.
So let me ask you your thoughts on this. I'm curious. One of the things that someone had said this to me a long time ago, but it is something that I see all the time, is when you meet an individual who is now in a position to apply creativity to their jobs or whatever in the way that you just described, not your mom, but in the way you described, like that you can or whatever, that I can. There is always a generation before that gave up.
Fair enough.
So much.
Fair
and I
enough.
See, you know, for my husband, I see what his parents had to give up.
Yeah.
Escaping from Czechoslovakia in the 60s. I see what my grandfather did working in the steel mills so that my dad could do, you know, so someone along the way bears a tremendous amount of burden. I see the team members in our office, yeah. Elaine, Tracy, her dad, Vietnam, like coming over, like these people, Anthony, you love Anthony, yes. Our head of production, you know, he's the first guy in his family to have attended college. So there is always someone before you that really gave something up. And I'm curious,
I really
with
appreciate
your,
that.
Right.
That's
and your mom.
True.
And so I'm curious with your mom, though, if you're seeking whatever it is that fulfills you, how much fulfillment did your mom get, though, in producing this?
There are three of us total.
Yeah.
She's gonna get me if she sees this. But I'll say it anyway. I think she talks to my brother on the phone.
Yeah.
Every day. I think she may talk to my sister on the phone every day.
And you.
We text at least once every day. You know, people look at some of the accolades I have and say, man, your mom must be proud of you. And if she's sitting here, she'll smile and say, yeah. But then we get to the car, she'll say, I was proud of you long before any of that.
I mean, if she thought that people were going to listen to you.
You know, so yeah. Here's what she did. And now I can reflect and see it clearly. My mom always gave up herself.
Mm-hmm.
She gave herself up for her children.
Yeah.
She gave up herself for work. I watched her give up, you know, the last few dollars she had to help someone else. She still does things like that. She's getting her master's degree in social work. Mm-hmm. So obviously she's committed to doing it for the rest of her life.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
beyond family. Yeah.
I think that rubbed off on me.
Yeah. I mean,
I think it, you know, I have pride, I have ego, like everyone else, especially if I feel like we're competing. But I also know that I'm not the most important thing in the room. I don't necessarily care about being that.
Yeah.
I think I add value when I walk into a room, but I'm not the most important because this world is bigger than us. It's more important. There are things that I have seen things in some of these communities that remind me that whatever I was, you know, whining about, it'll be okay.
And in those communities, you know that if they don't have someone at home willing to just be so selfless in that way, it's really hard to make anything work out. Someone's got to start at home, you know? I mean,
yeah, the heartbreaking truth is there are fewer
mm-hmm.
than there are.
Yeah.
You know, they're just, man, the challenges that some of these people face, you know, I have two children. I have a wife and two children. And the situation that we're in is drastically different than the one I was in when I was in my childhood. And I pull from that a lot, as you can tell, to rationalize information. But it's like, man, how does she do that? Because, you know, I spend 2 hours with my kids alone. And I'm like,
you're exhausted.
Hey, man.
Yeah.
Where's the grandmother at?
Yes.
I need a break, yes, you know? Yeah. But we have to stop fighting against ourselves.
Yeah.
Right? It's our individuality. And I learned this from you. It's our individuality that creates the most value wherever we are. And if your individuality doesn't create value, you're in the wrong place.
And you're in big trouble if you don't know what value is to begin with.
Correct. Well, that's different because now we have to determine what value means.
Right.
Right. And for me today, and I'm speaking from a point of some privilege, value is being able to exercise my thought in its entirety. If I cannot do that, then I probably don't want to be around.
I love that. Malcolm, thank you so much for being here. And before we go, we got to tell people, I mean, like, I want to support you in every way that we can. And I know others are going to want to as well. So first, how can people support your foundation?
Yeah. Spread the word. Talk about it. Visit our website at readwithmalcolm.com.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same on all social platforms as well. I did not delete those.
Yeah, good, good. Those should not be deleted.
Join our tribe.
Yeah.
You know, we're on a mission to inspire communities to read because we know it would allow them to exercise the best sides of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And having that support would mean a lot.
Okay, great. And then we have a lot of business people that listen here too. So you are an amazing speaker.
Oh, thank you.
And I know that that is going to continue to grow and help everything here? And then when is your next book coming out?
My next book is titled My Super Duper Me.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes out August 2026.
Wow.
And I'm looking forward to it.
And are you self-publishing that, or is that coming out? How is that coming out?
That's coming out with Scholastic.
Amazing.
So, yeah, check out some other books. Here's the other one here. I wrote this one right after Super Bowl 51.
Wow.
Now, it didn't release until years later, but I enjoy it.
Yeah.
And now my son will walk into a bookstore and see them and say, that's my dad and stuff like that. So,
This was such a great talk. It is such a great reminder to just follow your path, do what you can to determine your self-worth. And I think that I am just in awe that you are out there helping kids figure that out at a young age. The sooner you get on that path, the better. And I love what you're doing. We love you. I'm so glad.
I love you all, and I'm thankful. I'm thankful. This is a moment, and I appreciate it.